Welcome to the Western Spirit. Today we're with Professor Matt Goodwin from the University of Kent and a senior advisor at the Legitum Institute. Matt, just tell me if I said that correctly.
The Legatum Institute.
And also someone who I've been following for a number of years now and read some of his books. And so, Matt, it's a great honor to speak with you and at this crazy time. So we were talking before the show about, and I think this is what my first question would be, is that I've been watching, we had a few days ago this Iranian airstrike here, hundreds of missiles and UAV, unmanned drones coming here. And one of the things that I've been seeing is, at least in America, where I'm originally from, and I assume also from England, you have these protesters who are literally saying that they support Iran in this whole thing. And one of the things that you've been talking about is this whole woke culture, this hatred of Western values inside the West. And so how do you see what is happening, especially now?
Well, firstly, thank you for having me on. Secondly, I can share my thoughts with everybody in Israel who's experiencing the current situation. Turning our eyes to the West, I think what we're now realizing, what's become unavoidable since the October 7th atrocities, is that we, to be blunt, have lots of people within Western societies who really don't believe in our way of life, our values, our institutions, and certainly don't want to respect our national culture and the things that we prioritize. And every weekend here in the UK, we've had some very significant protests, which essentially I think represent what I call a toxic alliance between a radicalizing cultural left, sort of traditionally anti-Israel, anti-Semitic, anti-Western left that found its peak really with the election of Jeremy Corbyn as the leader of the Labour Party, but in alliance with radical violent Islamists within the UK, of which it's estimated there are somewhere around 10 to 15,000 hardcore Islamists within the country. And the protests have essentially allowed that alliance to really move into the public consciousness for people to see that quite openly. And I'm an academic researcher. I do a lot of work with polling, with surveys. And one of the things we have seen since October the 7th are a number of, you know, robust, reliable surveys which show how, you know, a large numbers of the people joining those protests do have very ugly views when it comes to things like Israel, when it comes to their view of Jews in Israel and in Britain, and also simply believing the events of October 7th. I mean, we've had a new survey last week which found 40% of British Muslims reject the idea that Hamas murdered and raped Jews on October 7th. I mean, this is a very different finding to what we find among the British public at large, where the large majority of people accept the events of October 7th. So look, what I'm trying to say is we have a very serious and growing problem within Western societies, which partly reflects our policies of mass migration, our broken policy of multiculturalism. We can come back perhaps and talk about why I think multiculturalism is broken.
Yeah.
But these have all created this situation, which in the aftermath of October 7th, we can now see. It's simply impossible now to argue that we do not have a problem in the aftermath of those attacks, because very clearly we do.
Matt, I just wanted to maybe take from what you just said and look at something that you've been written about, I think in your latest book, is about the realignment of politics in Great Britain, and probably in the US too, in terms of, you spoke about the great realignment, and a lot of the working class in America, and probably tell me if it's also true in Britain, that used to traditionally vote to the left, the Democrat Party, now vote for Trump and move to the Trump camp. And I guess maybe in Britain we see that too. So maybe, and I think a lot of it has to do with what you just said. People see these protests, for example, they see this extreme left that's taking over the more center left. So how do you see that realignment happening in Britain and maybe in the West in general?
Well, I think if you look at recent elections in Western democracies, what you've seen at very broad level are working class white voters moving to the right, non-graduates moving mm-hmm. to the right, people without university degrees, older voters often moving to the right. At the same time, you've seen university graduates moving left, you've seen professional middle-class voters yeah. moving left, you've seen women, especially young university-educated women, moving sharply to the left. And this has been really one of the broader stories behind the rise of people like Donald Trump, the vote for Brexit in Britain, the growing support for national populists across large parts of Europe. If you look, for example, at, you know, say, Giorgia Meloni in Italy or Marine Le Pen in right. France or the Sweden Democrats. Now, there are obviously some nuances from one country to the next. I mean, if you look at the US, you've seen Hispanic, Latino voters moving quite significantly to the right, alongside African Americans have also been moving to the right relative to 2016. And in Europe, you've seen quite a large number of young voters without university qualifications moving to the right. So, you know, there is no old, heavy dependence within national populism in places like France and Italy on older voters. Actually, they often do well among younger voters. But anyway, the key point in all of this is what I think we're living through is essentially a political realignment, which is reshaping the foundations of politics that were laid by the Industrial Revolution, when left-wing parties emerged to represent the workers and right-wing parties, conservative parties, essentially represented to emerge the middle classes and the landed elite. What we've seen now, 120, 130 years on from the rise of mass democracy, I think are simply those foundations beginning to crumble, new parties coming forward, targeting new issues that the old parties struggled to talk about, migration being one of them. Islam, I think, increasingly will be a big issue in Western democracies, multiculturalism, crime, woke ideology, gender issues, all those sorts of things. So the foundations of politics are basically being upended. Now, if you look at a country like Britain, the reason the Labour mm-hmm. Party is doing well in the polls now is precisely because it's been winning over large amounts of support from graduates, young voters, but also, to be frank, minority voters, British Muslims especially. Prior to October 7th, about 90% of British Muslims were planning to vote Labour. That's gone down to somewhere between 65 and 70%, depending on what poll you look at. We've got new parties emerging to try and appeal to that anti-Israel sentiment. We've got a politician like George Galloway, for example, who has been trying to direct British Muslims into a new distinctive Muslim party, essentially. And clearly you can see politics becoming much more sectarian along kind of religious lines. But overall, you know, I think the Labour Party has basically made a very conscious decision that it's going to be the party for minorities and middle-class professionals. And that's going to be its future electoral coalition.
Matt, could I just interject? One of the things that I remember when I was in the U.S. and it was Obama's second election for the second term was that they said that he was basically taking a coalition of the minorities to overcome his deficit in the white majority white country. And basically it was like they called it, if I'm not mistaken, a coalition of the oppressed. So do you think that because in Great Britain, the demography changed so much that you can actually win a national election with majority minority votes?
No, it's very, very difficult to do that. I mean, that's one of the reasons why the Democrats came unstuck. They basically bought into this narrative that demography is destiny, that if you just hold support among minorities, then basically, you know, you're moving in the same direction as history and you'll be okay. Well, actually, politics didn't really turn out that way. One of the problems with becoming over dependent upon minority voters is geography. Those voters tend to concentrate in big cities, in large urban areas, so they basically can't deliver you a big comprehensive victory under first past the post in two-party systems. It's very difficult for you to win. But also, the experience of the United States since Obama underlines how these voters are just as flexible and unpredictable as other voters. Many of the
right.
Latino Hispanic voters that have been moving from the Democrats to the Republicans were alienated, not just by things like the COVID lockdowns, but by things like defund the police, which were what I call luxury beliefs. I mean, this is a luxury belief by the elite among the elite class that you can basically dramatically reduce law and order in low-income disadvantaged communities, knowing full well as a member of the luxury belief class, you're not going to suffer the consequences of those decisions. So I think the reason that we've seen, if you look at the latest Gallup data, Donald Trump is doing almost as well as Joe Biden among Latino Hispanic voters. One of the big reasons is they were turned off by what they saw as this kind of return to radical socialism, the kind of politics they didn't really support from earlier in their lives or from what their parents had told them from their experiences right. in other countries.
And also, I would also just add to what you said, interestingly, that a lot of the Hispanic voters, especially in Texas, let's say in border states, they're not happy with open immigration. So the interesting thing about it is, and I think this probably works also in European countries where there's a big issue with immigration, is that a lot of the minority communities that the left seems to think will be so happy that you're opening the borders are the ones who get most harmed because of low wages that go down when you have an influx of low wage earners and stuff like that. And it's not just because you're a certain skin color that you're going to be automatically, I guess, for open borders. It's just a very weird way to think. And it's hurting the left in that sense, I think.
Well, I would just add to that. And if you look at, say, an issue like lowering immigration, that is supported by, about 40% of young people, but also often majorities of minority voters. And one of the reasons for that is because if you look at, say, British Hindu, Sikh, Muslim communities, they're often actually very socially conservative on a lot of issues,
right?
Including, by the way, a lot of the woke issues. So the expansion of gender identity theory, one of the reasons we have protests outside schools in England was not just because people were unhappy with foreign policy, but because they were unhappy with children being taught that there were 72 different genders. So what I'm trying to say here is within the left, there is a second dilemma emerging. And that's, the first dilemma was, well, how can you hold the working class and the middle class together? I think the second dilemma now is going to be, how do you hold white graduate liberals who are radically progressive together in the same coalition with minority voters, let's say with Muslim, Sikh, Hindu voters, who really don't support the expansion of woke ideology? That's going to be a very difficult dilemma for left-wing parties.
Yeah, and maybe one question that I think we in Israel don't really touch about, but it is one of the things you speak about a lot, because I think Western countries, maybe Israel is like a little bit of an outlier, because we are so... Also, there could be bad things about this. Very strong families, very traditional. Even people who aren't religious here are going to synagogue once, a few times a year. They're very, conservative in the way they look at the world. And so you don't have a lot of the woke issues or woke ideology hasn't permeated Israel and in its institutions the way places probably like Britain or the US it has. So maybe... And whenever I talk about this, people in Israel don't have a clue what we're saying. So what does it mean, woke ideology? How would you, I know it's like a funny question because we instinctively understand it. We understand what people who say there's like 1,000 genders, people who say open borders, abolish the police, they're all the time with blue hair and like earrings all over the place. But what does it actually mean to the woke ideology today, and how is it influencing Western institutions?
Well, sure. I mean, I think firstly, I imagine lots of people in Israel will have a strong sense of what it means simply given the response of Ivy League colleges to the attacks
exactly.
on October 7th, which I would consider to be really a reflection of woke ideology. So my definition would be that woke is really the sacralization of racial, sexual, and gender minorities. Okay, so racial, sexual and gender minorities are seen to be absolutely sacred. morally virtuous, morally righteous. They are seen to be the oppressed, and they are seen to be existing in a society whereby they are being continuously oppressed and discriminated against by morally inferior oppressor groups, which, by the way, include Jews and the white majority. So within this very simplistic binary us versus them framework, woke ideology is really about advancing the rights of racial, sexual, and gender minorities over and above everything else. So any evidence that challenges that, for example, evidence that might show minority groups doing particularly well in the education system is either ignored or discounted. And this is ultimately about the liberation of those minorities. So if you look, for example, at one recent scandal we've just had recently this month in April 2024 in Britain, we've had the scandal of the CAS review, a major review of what's been happening in our hospitals and clinics with regards to children who say they're gender distressed. They're not sure, are they a boy, are they a girl? They're not sure what's happening. And this review has basically shown how institutions of the state, taxpayer-funded institutions in the National Health Service, were basically pushing children down a medical pathway to transition to, you know, for a girl to become a boy to become a girl, if you believe that can happen. We're discounting, firstly, that those transitions, that pathway was based on almost no real empirical evidence at all. But secondly, they were also discounting any evidence which showed the importance of other factors like mental health, family trauma, family breakdown, experience of substance abuse, autism, all those sorts of things. So this is an example basically of how woke ideology, the sacralization in this case of a gender minority or gender minorities, trans identities, is basically put above and beyond everything else. So when Israelis look at this debate that we're having about woke, I think it is not just about culture wars. It is fundamentally about who we are. It's about an attack on our religious, national, cultural identities. It is a worldview that overwhelmingly says the history of the West is bad, not good. That Western identities are a source of shame and embarrassment, not pride. It is a worldview that is illiberal, that has no interest in individual rights. It is about fixed group identities above and beyond the individual. And it is basically revolutionary in the sense that it wants to overthrow established language, culture, ways of life, and societies, which is why it goes so well with radical Islamism. I mean, the woke left are kind of the useful idiots for radical Islamists in a sense, because they'll be the first ones to be sort of thrown under the bus if they're sort of, you know, radical Islamist regime. But what in the worldview of the woke, say for example, in what we've seen in the UK, you know, British Muslims, protesters on the streets singing, you know, from the river to the sea, all this kind of stuff. In the world of the woke, you know, they're the virtuous minorities. They're the morally oppressed minorities, and they should be encouraged and allowed to express their identities and their views on the streets of England. So they're enabling the rise of radical Islamism within British society because of this very warped worldview that they have. And it's a very elitist worldview, given that woke ideology, I would argue, has also become a crucial signifier of status for the elite, of social status, esteem, and recognition. That, you know, in the old days, the elite would demonstrate their wealth and their resource, their butlers and their holidays. Today, the new elite increasingly exhibit their allegiance to woke ideology to demonstrate their status and their credentials to other members of the elite. So it's become absolutely central to not just the Labour Party and left-wing parties across the West, but it's become absolutely essential and key to the elite graduate class, who now view this belief system as being fundamentally about the projection of their social status.
Do you think one of the reasons why woke, because we always had, it seems there always was sort of a neo-Marxist type of strain in universities, a sort of extreme radical left. There always was that in all Western societies, and to some degree or another, but it's exploding under this woke new type of thing in the last decade or so, especially in the last maybe 5 years, and especially since COVID, it seems it's been even worse. And do you think one of the reasons why maybe this is happening is because there's a sort of a crisis of meaning in the West? So, like, for example, church attendance has plummeted all over the Western countries. People don't seem to have any common goals. They seem very, what they're hearing from media and pop culture is that their countries are all bad, that they're all oppressors. And then they go to college and they hear it again. And then they have some sort of common goal, whether they're going to protest against Israel or the white man or whatever Black Lives Matter is at that, whatever the new fab is. And it gives them sort of a new purpose, whereas in the past they had the church, they had the community, they had, you know, volunteering, whatever. And now they're sort of lost, and they finally find it when they go to be with other people like them at the universities.
I think there's some truth to that. I think the collapse of religion, the collapse of national identity, the collapse of the big ideologies, the collapse of the end of the Cold War, I think all of these things removed reference points that were otherwise uniting larger numbers of people, or certainly removed some of the anchors that used to hold Western societies together. But I think the roots of this also go a long way back. I mean, if you know, even in some of the early post-war decades, I mean, historians, Tom Holland and others, would argue that woke can really be traced back to the, you know, Middle Ages, if not earlier. But let's just stay on more contemporary history. If you look at the post-war decades, for example, there were already a lot of social scientists in the 60s and 70s pointing to the rise of a new culture of narcissism, a therapeutic society, the rise of what Daniel Bell called the adversity class, a sort of elite that was basically anti-Western, that was hostile towards Western institutions, that sort of derived its status from that position. And I think then if you fast forward to today, you know, the onset of social media, of smartphones, has kind of put that narcissism on steroids, and woke ideology, which I would think has really been trickling out of the universities since the 60s, is really perfectly wired for that, because it essentially turns you into, particularly if you're a young university student or a young university graduate looking for some meaning in your life, it is basically hardwired to turn you, you know, overnight, if you want to, into a kind of morally virtuous, righteous victim on the basis of your fixed identity, or as an ally of an oppressed group. So it instantly gives you a role in society that is fundamentally based around group identity. And so for Gen Z, and perhaps for the younger millennials, the onset of woke ideology, I think, really provided them, gave them a sense of purpose at a time when many of the other established narratives were collapsing. I mean, it's very difficult for established politics in this environment to demonstrate credibility and competence, because if you look at Gen Z and millennials, you know, all they've seen, all they've grown up with is, you know, the legacy of 9/11, the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, inequality, the global financial crash, the COVID lockdowns, the escalation of debt, housing crises, we can go on and on. It's not as if actually the sort of big narratives and ideologies that we have of our time provided them with any meaning. And religion, certainly, while it could provide them with a sense of meaning, you know, the reality here in Britain, just to give you one stat, is if you look at Gen Z, only 1% of Gen Z, I say, they identify with the Church of England. 1% say
1%.
1% say they identify with the Church of England. So, you know, what I'm saying is that the power of religion, of Christianity in this case, to really inspire and motivate the masses as a counterweight to woke ideology simply isn't there in a way that it once was.
I heard Matt late, I don't remember if it was you or someone else that said, just tell me if you agree with this, that the woke culture of today is almost a religion within itself, because they have sacraments, they have leaders in which they basically find as like spiritual, you know, prophets. They yeah. have a sort of like repetitive chants, like all religions prayer. They have like sacrifices that they make at the altar. I remember during the Black Lives Matter movement, when my dad lives in New York City, and people were walking up to black people were walking up with taking videos of themselves to white people on the subway and saying, please apologize for your white privilege. And you had white people just apologizing to this random person who's walking up to them and saying how sorry they are and apologizing for. And it was just, it seemed so, for someone like me, it seemed unreal. Like, it doesn't make any sense. But I guess when you live in sort of a religion, like in Judaism, you won't understand Passover and eating the crackers that we eat. And, you know, but so someone who's outside of the religion won't understand this, the internal codes of the religion. Do you agree that a lot of this woke stuff is already in sort of a religious territory?
Yeah, certainly this is an argument that that I think John McWhorter at Columbia has made quite forcefully, and Tom Holland to some extent as well has made this argument. I think, yeah, I mean, there is no doubt that the woke ideology, social justice ideology, has all the hallmarks of a new religion. It has its sacred creed, its sacred you know, belief system that you cannot question. That's equivalent to blasphemy. It has its rituals, as you say. It's very suspicious of objective scientific research.
Right.
In fact, it doesn't really like any research that sort of challenges or questions its claims. And it's organized around you know, the true believers, the kind of highly yeah. committed 10 to 15% who really go out and spread the word and spread the gospel. And it's done a very good job so far at taking over a lot of the institutions and kind of imposing this worldview from the top down. In fact, you might argue that the universities are the new sort of citadels of this religion. Maybe it doesn't need cathedrals; it just needs a university campus. But yeah. on a more serious note, you know, if we were talking about a set of ideas, a body of ideas that, you know, were limited and restricted to 5% of the country, then perhaps I'd be less worried about it than I am, given that we know that actually the sheer power and influence of these ideas has really, you know, become visible to everybody over the last decade. And I think we've brought home powerfully in terms of what's happened in the elite universities by the response to October 7th, where you saw you know, the most senior leaders of Ivy League colleges, Harvard, Penn, and MIT, essentially falling over themselves to downplay and refuse to condemn anti-Semitism on American campuses, on the most elite campuses in the US. And that was yeah. because of the extent to which these ideas have become dominant within university life. And one of these silver linings within that debate in the United States about education, about higher education, for me at least, is that we're now beginning to get our way to a more mature discussion about what we mean by things like diversity, equity, and inclusion. And we're beginning to see serious financial donors withdraw their funds from the university, saying, you know what, I'm not going to play ball with institutions that are permitting some forms of prejudice, but not others. And we've even seen DEI departments in southern states, Texas, and elsewhere actually be closed in recent weeks.
Right.
So what I think we're beginning to see now, maybe going into the November election, obviously, potentially a change of incumbent in the White House. But I think we're beginning to see is this kind of significant and possibly sustained shift in the public debate about woke ideology and what it is, and if we do end up seeing a return of, say, Donald Trump, if Europe moves to the right in the spring, I suspect that will prompt a lot of soul searching on the left of politics, whereby people might actually have to conclude that this ideology, this set of ideas, has been turning off voters.
But do you think that in the long run, we as the West are a little bit, and as you said, a lot of the mistakes that were made was thinking that demographics are destiny. But on the other hand, maybe in the long run, they are destiny. And like, I was looking at a poll of American support for Israel, and Americans support Israel overwhelmingly. But then when you go down to the 18 to 24 year olds, it's a 100% like, and 180, and like almost support for Hamas in large numbers, and very anti-Israel, and it's not even anti the Israeli government, which is fine. I don't really like the current government also, but there's a difference between like totally being for Hamas and saying I have certain, you know, things that I disagree with the government. And that's the 18 to 24 year olds. So if we're looking maybe 10 years up the road, 20 years up the road, the next leaders of our time in the US, UK, the rest of Europe, are we screwed? Sorry for the language.
The short answer is we don't know. We don't know whether mm-hmm. this is an effect that's limited to this particular time, or whether they're going to hold on to these attitudes and carry them through. What I think it's safe to say we do know is that we've never had young people in the West before to this extent, not only holding anti-Israel views, but also holding anti-Western views in general. Other examples being, we've never seen levels of opposition to the royal family, to
right.
the Western institutions, as we've seen today. But I think also the risk is that many of those attitudes now will, or many of those young people are going to be colliding with more religiously, culturally, ethnically diverse societies, which are also going to hold very different views on these issues. I'll give you a couple of examples from my Substack, which I published a piece last week on what British Muslims here are thinking about these issues. Just a few stats. 40% of British Muslims reject the suggestion that Hamas committed murder and rape. The youngest British Muslims, 18 to 24 year olds, were even more likely than their older counterparts to reject the suggestion that Hamas committed murder and rape. Nearly half of all British Muslims, 46%, say their sympathy is definitely with or leans towards Hamas over Israel. That rises to 60% among the youngest Muslims. Wow. And then in terms of holding positive or negative attitudes of Hamas, only 8% of the British public say they hold a positive view of Hamas, and that's 30% among British Muslims and 34% among the youngest Muslims. So you've got widespread sympathy for the actions. You've got about coming up to a third of all British Muslims, which will be a million or so, maybe higher, who are saying openly they have positive views of Hamas after October 7th, 6 months on. And you've got only 8% of British people holding the same view. And I think also half of British Muslims saying Israel does not have a right to exist as a Jewish homeland. Just about wow. half of British Muslims. Now, if you look at the projections of where Britain's going to go over the next 12 years, and I've written about this as well, we are, if you look at the Pew Research Center, which is one of the most reliable, rigorous research centers in America, they've done projections for Europe, and they show that by 2030, Britain will experience the largest increase of all European states in the absolute number of Muslims, which will increase to about 6 million. So if you think these attitudes are pretty endemic now, especially among younger Muslims, then what's going to happen over the next 10, 20 years as a country is transformed in this way? And as those groups collide with a younger generation of Brits or French or Italian or American Gen Z and Gen Alpha who are coming behind them, and they're going into institutions, the schools, universities that are more explicitly, left wing in how they view these issues. I think as you look ahead, these challenges are only going to escalate. I mean, these challenges are going to become quite intense unless we now can begin to reform the institutions and actually do something different. Now, if we can't, then we're going to be, I think, in trouble. If we can, then right. I think, we can begin to turn things around.
Matt, you mentioned this before, and I think one of the reasons why maybe you can't is this whole debate over multiculturalism. And I think it means a lot of different things for a lot of different people. But growing up in New York City, you know, I remember going to my more liberal family members, and they were saying liberal in the American sense, and they kept on saying that, oh, look, there's so many different people from so many walks of life. New York is so multicultural. But then you, like you mentioned before, you had the fact that we're giving making it easier for people based on their color of their skin or their cultural identity to get ahead. So as opposed to other people like white people or Jewish people or even Asians in America who are very successful in universities. So does multiculturalism in the way we look at it today basically say to and I think we see it in the DEI, the whole debate over DEI, say to minorities that we're going to give you everything on a silver platter because you're minorities, because you're the oppressed, and therefore there's no way to reform anything because it's anytime someone is not doing as well as we want to, we're basically pushing them up on everyone else's expense.
Well, I think one of the problems with multiculturalism that we have as a policy, there's a difference between having, say, a multi-ethnic society and a policy of multiculturalism, which is a policy that is pursued to try and manage that society and the different groups that exist within it. Multiculturalism as a policy, I think the problem is that it promotes group difference. It promotes group identities, the need to keep those identities, ways of life and values distinctive and separate from one another. It promotes group difference over commonality, right? Multiculturalism really does not assert, it proactively promote links, unity, and bonds, or bridges between different groups. What it does is it sort of offers a very thin framework, which basically is about adhering to the administration of the state. So, you know, getting a passport or learning the language or respecting the rule of law, but never really actually having to take on the values, the norms, the ways of life, the history, the culture of that national community. And it doesn't really establish deep enough bonds between different groups. And even worse, I would argue that today, with a sort of new ruling class in many Western societies, what we've actually got is a model of asymmetrical multiculturalism. And what I mean by that is that if you are from the majority group, you are essentially discouraged from preserving and promoting your distinctive identity, history, and values. But if you are from a minority group, you are encouraged to preserve and promote your distinctive identity, culture, and values. And even worse, if you're in the majority, you are also simultaneously told that you must reshape and rewire your identity, history, and values around universal liberal themes like celebrating diversity, celebrating multiculturalism. But of course, to say that you're supportive of diversity is fine, but it's almost like saying you don't really have an identity of your own, because if the only thing that is actually defining who you are is the fact that you're open to difference, that you're open to novelty, to change. Who are you, right? It's about defining yourself relative to an external thing. So, and the new elite, the kind of people that I would argue dominate many of the institutions in the West today, are instinctively comfortable with that because, you know, they hold those universal liberal values and outlooks, and they largely define themselves by that. So they don't really want to derive their status and source of pride and source of esteem from their national identity, because they view that fundamentally as a bit awkward, as something they don't really like. They certainly don't want to discuss it. We see this in Britain, for example. Every time we have a sporting moment, it is never about celebrating who we are. It's about celebrating how diverse the team is, or how wonderfully multicultural the opening ceremony was, or you know how excellent diversity is. None of it is actually about us. None of it is actually about who we are as a people and as a country.
Well, I would just say, Matt, I would just as an anecdote, something about that I just read about, that the I think it's the NCAA women's basketball in America, college basketball, the number one player right now is a white basketball women's female player. And she is being, there's a few other basketball players who are playing, who are complaining that she is getting all the attention and it's not fair because she's white. And just the fact is that she's getting all, she's the points leader of the sport right now. And they're angry that she's white and therefore she doesn't deserve, it's like taking away, I guess, from black players' achievements or something. And I was thinking about it, that if it was the other way around in today's culture and someone would say something like that about a black person or a Hispanic person or any other race, it would be like, they would get canceled, fired, they would get fined, they would get like shunned from society. And it seems like it's just, like you said, it's like we all know how tolerant we are of others, but we're so easily, like we have no sense of, it's like, it's as you said, it's only goes one way. So, and another example, which I think you'd find interesting, is that in the US they had the solar eclipse. And just now last week, and NASA had their live cam, NASA, federal agency dedicated to science, and obviously, and they had their own, I guess, cameras feed online. And at one point, they went to one of their experts, and who was this expert? He was a Native American scholar who explained why the solar eclipse is basically a Native American sign where it shows that people have sinned and it's a reflection of how bad society is and the gods or whoever are sending us messages. And it was taken very seriously on federal, an agency that is dedicated to science again. And I was thinking that if they had, let's say, a Christian or rabbi or Orthodox rabbi or a fundamentalist Christian pastor on saying, you know, this is all because we've sinned and therefore God is taking the sun and blocking it, everybody in the entire media complex would say, are you crazy? What is wrong with you? But because it's sort of like we have to bow down to, as you said, multiculturalism, so we can't be critical of anything, anyone who's not Western in the traditional sense, we're like almost scared to say. And so I think that is the only reason why they would put a Native American, a spiritual leader on an event dedicated to science. It was just like so ridiculous.
Yeah, but I think in some respects, the symbols that we point to, you know, for example, teaching that mathematics is racist and this,
right,
this undermining of you know, the legacy of the Enlightenment, the legacy of, you know, civilization, you know, is also very serious. I mean, when we're, you know, to go back to some of the issues that we've seen here in Britain, when you're looking at what we're doing to children, as an example, you know, socially, yeah, transitioning children, which we, you know, essentially asking them, you know, do they want to be a boy? Do they want to be a girl? And which pronouns come with that? And schools doing, mm-hmm, that, actually, it's just being revealed without the consent of parents. And we know that socially, wow, transitioning children makes it more likely they'll go down a medical pathway. And we know those pathways are not based on reliable evidence. So let's just be absolutely clear, because what the left like to do is they say, well, the, you know, when you talk about these issues, you're talking about culture wars. Let's be absolutely clear what we mean. When you're talking about women's sex-based rights, when you're talking about the rights of children, when you're talking about our national history, when you're talking about our national values, these are not culture wars. These are who we are. This is our identity, exactly, right? And we want to preserve, we want to protect, we want to promote who we are because we're proud of who we are. And what they want to do, or what many people on the kind of cultural radicalized left want to do, is essentially reconfigure who we are. They want to reshape our national identity so it isn't national at all. And they want to erode the foundations of our institutions, our values, and our culture in the same way that all revolutionary ideologies like to do that because they want to wipe the slate clean and start again. And, you know, that's ultimately, I think, where we are on a lot of these issues. And my concern more than anything is also with regard to the events of the last 6 months. What's become quite clear to, I think, everybody in the West is not just how insecure and fragile geopolitics really is today and how close we are to another major global war, but actually it is witnessing the extent to which we have invited people into our countries who really hate who we are. And that, I think, has been a real eye-opener for a lot of people. I mean, I speak to a lot of people in London, in British Jews, non-Jews, and they are saying the same thing to me. Young Gen Z conservatives, members of the British Jewish community, saying they don't really think their long-term future will be in Britain. You know, either because they're unhappy, you know, they can't get on the housing ladder, mass immigration is overwhelming, nothing works, public services are a mess, or also because they fundamentally feel unsafe. You know, they fundamentally feel as though they are they're under threat because of the changes that have swept through Britain. So I'm deeply skeptical and worried about the direction of our society.
Yes. And one of the things that I've heard you, I think it was not too long ago, give a speech about is populism and the rise of populism and why. I found it very interesting because every time you hear someone mention populism in the academic world, it's in a negative way, meaning that it's always brought up as like, oh, look at these crazy populists. They don't know what they're saying. They're all dangerous. They're going to bring us to dictatorship, et cetera, et cetera. And you basically said that, first of all, the populism that we're seeing now, you explained, has certain beliefs where it's not just, you know, something like that comes out of nowhere. And second of all, you explained why it's rising now. So maybe you can just, in short, what is populism as we're seeing it now? And why is it gaining so much steam in Europe? We're seeing the elections coming up. A lot of the what's called populist right is gaining in the polls. Why are we seeing this?
I think it's a really interesting question. Populism I define as a movement that prioritizes the culture and the interests of the nation state, of the national community, against an elite which it argues is corrupt, self-serving, or neglectful. But populism, national populism, which prioritizes a nation, has been really, you know, firstly, it's been with us for over 100 years, goes back to the People's Party in the United States. But more recently, obviously, has found expression through things like Donald Trump, through the rise of national populists in Europe, Marine Le Pen, and some might say Brexit had elements of it too. Why are these movements becoming much more successful? Well, my argument would be because they're really tapping into four very closely related drivers. Firstly, they're tapping into people's concerns, as we were just talking about the destruction of their national identity and their ways of life, largely because of immigration. They feel that immigration has become way too, you know, too fast, too much, too soon. They secondly have parallel fears about the relative deprivation of their group. And what I mean by that is populism is strongest when people feel that their wider group is being economically or culturally left behind relative to other groups in Western societies. So whether that's immigrants, whether it's wealthy bankers, whether it's the elites, but that sense of relative deprivation, relative to others, my group is now losing out. Thirdly, have very high levels of distrust in the established institutions, in the universities, in parliaments, in the media, in creative industries, and that is leading to an erosion of trust in the expert class, in the people ruling over us. Lastly, in all Western democracies, we've moved into this era of de-alignment, whereby people are no longer loyal to the old parties in the way that they once were. So voters have become much more volatile, and they, you know, to be honest, they're looking at politics like they go to the supermarket. You know, they're picking products in a way that isn't really about long-standing loyalty. So if you look at you know, Giorgia Meloni's ability to win elections in Italy, or, you know, even Emmanuel Macron's ability to come from nowhere, or Donald Trump's ability to become president and then to run again. You know, what we are entering into is an era whereby politics has simply become much more volatile and unpredictable and chaotic. So this era of de-alignment is also lying behind national populism. And I suspect, you know, the argument in that book in 2018 was that populists would be here to stay, right? That these movements weren't really going to go anywhere. And I think if you look at the polling for the European Parliament elections in the spring, the big gains are likely going to be national populists. If you look at the latest numbers in the US, with Trump and Biden, I mean, it looks like, in my view, Trump's probably going to win re-election. You look at what's happening in Argentina, you know, you look at what's happening across large parts of Europe, it's the same story. I mean, populists basically aren't going anywhere anytime soon, because really the grievances and the underlying concerns of their voters have not really been met. I mean, we're nearly 10 years on from the 2016 revolts, and even now, you know, the grievances have not really been addressed.
Is populism really so we understood why and who they are, but do you agree that it could be a dangerous trend, or is the people who are the people that are calling it a dangerous trend being populist themselves in the negative sense and trying to just win over elections and scare people?
I think obviously there are movements that will have the potential to slip into from radical politics to more extreme politics. You know, we've seen that in places like Germany with the AfD. Right. We've seen it in Greece with Golden Dawn, among others. I do think at the same time, however, that national populism as a movement is not anti-democratic. It sort of wants to work within democracy, but it advocates a different conception of democracy. It advocates direct democracy. It's about trying to position the masses against what it argues is a corrupt insular elite, but it's not overtly anti-democratic. I mean, if you look, for example, at most national populists in Europe, you know, they're not calling for the complete overthrow and abolition of the European Union. Most of them want to stay within the European Union now. Very few national populists now saying, you know, they want zero immigration. You know, they're sort of saying they want some, but they don't want mass migration. So I'm not talking about extremist political parties or extremist political movements, because we also now have laws to deal with those. You know, Germany can ban movements that it views as violating the constitution. In the UK, we prescribe any groups that we associate with political extremism and or violence. So, you know, there is always the potential for populists to kind of, you know, darken the public debate and the national conversation. But one of the things I've tried to do, at least, unlike many of my colleagues, is try and focus on the role of this elite in really failing to address the reasons why so many people are voting for those movements in the first place. And that is really the fundamental task that we face.
I have a few just short questions. Number one, do you think the fact that it looks like in Europe the trends are moving, like you said, in numerous elections that are coming up and in the European Parliament elections that are, I don't remember exactly when, but they should be coming soon, the right and the more populist right is gaining a lot of steam. And you have like Wilders in Holland, who's very pro-Israel. And a lot of these populist right movements in Europe are much more pro-Israel than the people who are ruling the European countries now. So do you think that Israelis should be happy with this trend in terms of just as a, it's obviously not what's driving it, but will this be one of the side effects of what's going to happen? A more supportive European continent towards Israel?
Well, I mean, I think many of the parties, I don't know all of the parties in detail, but quite a few of them are explicitly anti-Islamist and are openly pro-Israel. Wilders would be one example.
Right.
I think there are others. You look at, say, British politics, somebody like Nigel Farage, I think would be instinctively pro-Israel. So, I mean, I think, you know, that certainly... that's certainly something to watch. I suppose a question in return would be, how would Israel feel about the US election in November? Would Israel prefer President Trump?
Well, Israelis just had a poll, and there was just a poll about, asked Israelis, who would you vote for if you were American? And Trump wins by like 70% of the vote in Israel. So I think that answers the question. When the October 7th thing happened and Biden came here, they did the same poll and Biden was beating Trump handily. And I guess with time, and I agree with Israelis on this point, Biden has shown that he's less reliable than what when Trump was here. And that is what it is. But I was just thinking that it seems that a lot of the Israel is, and maybe this harps on what we were talking about the whole conversation. Israel is considered a part of the West, meaning that if you hate America, you'll hate Israel. If you hate the UK, you'll also hate Israel. If you hate, I don't know, Europe, you'll also hate Israel. If you hate white people, because that's the new thing, white privilege, etc., you'll also hate Israel because for some reason we're considered right, even though ethnically most of the Israelis are not Ashkenazic European Jews. They're more people from Arab countries, but that's besides the point. So I think explicitly that if you're a party that supports Western values, you'll probably also support more or less Israel in some way or another. And I think that's what I was trying to get at in general.
Yeah. Well, but I think also for historic reasons, again, I think there'll be lots of reasons for the Jews to also feel somewhat nervous about the long-term trajectory of many of those parties. I mean, if you look at French politics, for example, it wasn't that long ago that we had frontline populists questioning the events of the Second World War. So I would sort of, you know, treat all of that with a big pinch of salt.
Yeah. One last question that I have for you, because I know we're coming short, that I just, you mentioned it earlier, but I just want to understand. The whole Europe, and you've been writing about the realignment of British politics, European politics, Western politics in general, is moving more to the right. We spoke about populism. We spoke about people being anxious about this woke ideology that seems to be permeating. But the other hand, as you mentioned before, the Labour seems to be, if the election were held today, they would probably win. At least that's what it seems to me from looking far. So what is the Conservative Party doing? It seems to me that they're sort of being like a pale, mirror of the Labour Party. Why wouldn't you be, just as a political expediency, why wouldn't the Conservative Party be more conservative?
Because, the Conservative Party leans much further to the cultural left than most voters. It has not really understood how the ground has shifted after Brexit. It's given people the opposite of what they wanted. It's given them more immigration, people wanted less. It's failed to control the borders, people didn't want to see that. It's failed to withdraw the country from European courts to turn Britain into a truly independent, sovereign nation that can control its own borders. And the Conservative Party has never really understood what the last 10 years were all about, because the Tory Party is about the Tory Party. So what I think we're on the cusp of is a new political upheaval in Britain over the next 10 years. We can already see it in the polls. We've got new parties coming and going. I think basically we are on the cusp of seeing the Conservative Party really now suffer a heavy, if not historic, defeat. And that's going to be very difficult for many Conservatives. But I think my personal view would be it's entirely justified given how they've managed the country over the last 14 years. So thank you very much.
Professor Matt Goodwin, it was an honor, very interesting. And I think what you have to say is important for Israelis to hear, because we don't really understand what's happening a lot of these times. And it's just very weird sometimes. And it's good to have people like you explain it to us. So I hope you'd come back. But for now, it was amazing.